I'm Joel Chandler. Welcome to another episode of Unsealed. In most episodes, I take you behind the scenes for a look at various open government projects that I'm working on, or we discuss issues relating to open government in Florida. But occasionally, we take time to talk about what happens when authority operates in the shadows. In those episodes, we tell stories that remind us why government transparency matters. That's what we're going to do today. This is a story about how law and secrecy did the work of a conspiracy. It's about the machinery of power that allowed Jeffrey Epstein to operate with impunity for years. But it's also about something equally disturbing. What happens when the institutions designed to expose such corruption, our newspapers, our investigative journalists, begin to disappear? Because the Epstein story isn't just about one predator or one corrupt deal. It's about what we lose when the watchdogs stop watching. Jeffrey Epstein was a predator hiding in plain sight. He walked the halls of privilege with Wall Street connections, vast wealth, and Caribbean island getaways that served as the backdrop for his crimes. But beneath this veneer of respectability, a darker story was unfolding. In March 2005, Palm Beach police received a report that would begin to unravel Epstein's carefully constructed facade. A parent reported that he had sexually abused her 14-year-old daughter. What followed was a thorough 13-month investigation by Palm Beach police that would uncover a systematic pattern of abuse. The following year, in May 2006, the FBI opened their own investigation into Jeffrey Epstein, codenamed Operation Leap Year. Federal officials ultimately identified 36 girls, some as young as 14 years old, whom Epstein had allegedly sexually abused. The investigation was thorough and damning. The FBI compiled reports on 34 confirmed minors eligible for restitution, a number that would later be increased to 40 in the non-prosecution agreement. These allegations included corroborating details that painted a picture of systematic abuse. By June 2007, investigators had prepared a 53-page federal indictment that could have sent Epstein to prison for life. But then something extraordinary happened. Alexander Acosta, then the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida, agreed to a plea deal that Alan Dershowitz helped negotiate. This deal would grant immunity from all federal criminal charges to Epstein, along with four named co-conspirators, and any unnamed potential co-conspirators. The chronology and details of this deal are documented extensively by both the Miami Herald's investigations and DOJ internal documents that have since been released. What Jeffrey Epstein received in September 2007 was a non-prosecution agreement, an NPA that reads like something out of a political thriller. The deal was extraordinary in its scope and secrecy. According to the Miami Herald, the non-prosecution agreement essentially shut down an ongoing FBI probe into whether there were more victims and other powerful people who took part in Epstein's sex crimes. The agreement didn't just protect Epstein. It cast a protective shield over anyone who might have been involved in his operations. But here's what makes this deal truly shocking. The victims weren't told about it. The Miami Herald reported that Acosta agreed, despite a federal law to the contrary, that the deal would be kept from the victims. This violated the Crime Victims' Rights Act, which mandates that victims be informed of and have input on plea agreements that affect their cases. The secrecy was so complete that prosecutors actively misled victims. Acosta's office sealed the agreement with the court and misled victims into believing that a federal prosecution of Epstein and his co-conspirators was still a possibility. Some victims continued to cooperate with what they believed was an ongoing investigation, unaware that the case had already been closed. The level of coordination between prosecutor and defense was highly unusual. Epstein's attorneys even sent a letter to Acosta after their October meeting, thanking him for promising confidentiality and asking him not to contact victims. This wasn't standard prosecutorial procedure. It was active collaboration in concealment. Instead of facing potential life in prison on federal sex trafficking charges, Epstein pleaded guilty to two state charges, soliciting prostitution and procuring a minor for prostitution. He served just 13 months in Palm Beach County Jail, with work release privileges allowing him to leave the facility 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to work at a comfortable office. Unlike other convicted sex offenders, Epstein didn't face the rough justice that child sex offenders typically encounter in state prison. Instead, he was housed in a private wing of the Palm Beach County Jail. Fast forward to 2017. When Alexander Acosta was nominated to be President Trump's labor secretary, Miami Herald investigative reporter Julie K. Brown saw an opportunity to revisit a story that had never been properly told. Despite her editor's initial skepticism that she could add new dimensions to a known story, Brown was determined to center the voices of the victims themselves. She began investigating Epstein in early 2017, persisting in uncovering facts about the large number of accusers and the pressure campaign to silence them. Brown's methodology was meticulous and exhaustive. By carefully combing through public records, she was able to identify approximately 80 possible victims. She reached about 60 of them, and multiple victims spoke with her on the record for the series. These were victims as young as 13 and 14 years old when the abuse occurred, now young women struggling to reclaim their lives after the trauma and shame they had endured. It was important to her that everything in the story was backed up by public records, a footnote to the investigation notes that the Herald obtained thousands of FBI and court records, lawsuits, and witness depositions, and went to federal court in New York to access sealed documents. But Brown didn't work alone. The Miami Herald didn't just assign one reporter to this story. Emily Michaud, a videographer, collaborated with Brown to create multimedia content. Together, their collaboration became something of a force multiplier, creating a three-dimensional platform for Epstein's victims to tell their harrowing stories. Brown's series drove over 9.5 million unique views, while Michaud's videos hit 850,000 views on the paper's website alone. Her three-part series, titled Perversion of Justice, was published in November 2018. The series covered the extensive number of accusers in the Epstein case and the role of federal prosecutor Alex Acosta, who had permitted a non-prosecution agreement that protected four named conspirators and granted immunity to any possible co-conspirators, a proviso that seemed to protect the powerful men Epstein partied with. The series was explosive because it didn't just rehash old news. It revealed how the system had failed these victims at every level. In 2019, a federal judge agreed that the 2007 secret deal violated the Crime Victims' Rights Act, ruling that victims should have been informed and given a voice in the proceedings. Brown had been warned by former police chief Michael Rader to expect pushback, as other members of the media who attempted to report on Epstein had been reassigned following phone calls to their publishers. Rader stated, "Somebody's going to call your publisher, and the next thing you know, you're going to be assigned to the obituaries department." But the Herald stood behind Brown's work, and the impact was immediate and far-reaching. This wasn't a simple case of prosecutorial discretion gone wrong. The more you examine the details, the more orchestrated it appears. The most explosive claim emerged years later, when details surfaced about what Acosta allegedly told Trump's transition team when he was being considered for labor secretary. According to multiple media reports citing a former senior White House official, when asked about the Epstein case during his confirmation process, Acosta allegedly explained that he'd cut the non-prosecution deal because he had been told to back off, that Epstein was above his pay grade. The reported quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." But we must be very careful about this claim. As Josh Marshall of Talking Points Memo noted, it's quite hard to know what to make of this claim. The dialogue itself seems more out of Hollywood than something you'd hear from a former U.S. attorney. On its face, this sounds like second or third hand information, which puts some question over its reliability. More importantly, Acosta is hardly a reliable fact witness in this case. He has every reason to deflect responsibility for the deal he made with Epstein. This remains an unverified claim that has never been independently confirmed. When Acosta was directly asked about it at a 2019 press conference, he gave an evasive response rather than confirming or denying it. What we do know for certain comes from a subsequent DOJ internal review. In November 2020, the Department of Justice's Office of Professional Responsibility concluded that Alex Acosta exercised poor judgment when he gave Jeffrey Epstein the non-prosecution agreement. However, the review explicitly did not find that Acosta or other prosecutors engaged in professional misconduct. Crucially, the DOJ review found no evidence that Acosta's decision was based on corruption or other impermissible considerations such as Epstein's wealth, status, or associations. The review examined over 60 witnesses and hundreds of thousands of records, concluding that while the decision was flawed, it was within Acosta's authority and not the result of improper influence. This distinction is important. The DOJ found poor judgment, not criminal conduct or corruption. In 2012, I was invited to the annual convention of the American Society of News Editors. The event is a who's who of legacy journalism and was held in a massive hotel complex in Washington, D.C. I was there to receive an award for open government activism. To say the American Society of News Editors convention is a big deal doesn't really capture its significance in the journalism world. This annual gathering brings together hundreds of newspaper publishers and editors from across the country, the decision makers from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and dozens of other major publications. It's essentially the summit meeting of American journalism's institutional power. The 2012 convention was particularly notable because it fell during the presidential election cycle. One afternoon, we attended a luncheon with President Obama. The next afternoon, another luncheon with Republican candidate Mitt Romney. To be clear, these are not the social circles I normally travel in. The entire event felt like being inside the machinery of how information flows in America, watching the people who decide what stories get told, what investigations get funded, and what truths get buried or elevated. As I made my way through the maze of hallways looking for the ballroom where the award ceremony was being held, I noticed someone else nearby who also looked a little lost. We were maybe 6 feet apart. He turned to me and asked if I knew where the ballroom was. I said I didn't, but I was looking for it too. Then I asked, "You're Carl Bernstein, right?" And he smiled graciously and said, "Yes, I am." I was in awe. Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward were the investigative journalists that exposed Watergate. It isn't hyperbole to say that Woodward and Bernstein inspired thousands of young people to pursue careers in journalism, and I was standing in a hallway in Washington, D.C. talking to one of them. It was surreal. A short while later, I stood on stage in front of a room full of newspaper publishers and editors to accept my award presented by the editor of USA Today. I gave a short speech about the importance of transparency and the shrinking role legacy media was playing in enforcing it. And later that same day, I sat in the audience as Carl Bernstein joined Bob Woodward for a panel discussion titled, "Could Watergate Happen Today?" It was a double-edged question. On one side, with the explosion of citizen journalism and social media, would something like Watergate even unfold the same way? And on the other, without the resources of legacy media, could any newsroom devote the time, money, and institutional backing to relentlessly pursue a story like that again? The answers weren't encouraging. Bernstein was blunt. He said what had taken generations to build, an independent press with the capacity to hold power accountable, was being dismantled by corporate owners who saw journalism as a liability, not a civic duty. Bob Schieffer added that while some scandals might still be uncovered nationally, in many local communities where newspapers had withered or disappeared entirely, there was simply no one left to do the digging. In my own speech earlier that day, I had made a similar point. I said, the greatest threat to our democracy is not terrorism or radicalism. It's the death of America's newsrooms. Because if investigative journalism disappears, the truth disappears with it. And that brings us back to perversion of justice. Julie K. Brown didn't just uncover a story. She reopened a case the entire system had quietly buried, but she didn't do it alone. She had time, resources, legal support, and an institution behind her. Despite her editor's skepticism that she could add new dimensions to a known story, Brown determined that her goal would be to track down the victims themselves. Poring over thousands of redacted court documents, traveling across the country, and chasing down information in difficult and sometimes dangerous circumstances, Brown tracked down dozens of Epstein's victims. Without that institutional support, without legacy media, Epstein's deal stays hidden. His co-conspirators stay anonymous, and the victims stay voiceless. The outrage from Brown's reporting led to Epstein's arrest, the eventual arrest of his closest accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell, and the resignation of Acosta. Jeffrey Berman, a federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York, commented at a news conference that his team had been assisted by some excellent investigative journalism. Here's what's especially concerning for the future of accountability journalism. In Florida, many of the landmark appellate decisions affirming the public's right to access government records were brought and won by legacy media organizations. Newspapers and television stations weren't just storytellers, they were litigants. They had the resources to sue when public agencies stonewalled. As resources of legacy media diminishes, so do those institutions with the legal and financial ability to push back. The rise of citizen journalists, podcasters, bloggers may give us some hope, but let's be honest. They don't have in-house counsel, deep pockets, or patient editors who can afford to bankroll a First Amendment fight. That kind of institutional pressure requires institutional backbone to resist. Individual bloggers and citizen journalists, no matter how dedicated, rarely have the legal and financial resources to withstand prolonged campaigns designed to silence them. When legacy media goes, the watchdogs go with it, and that's something democracy cannot afford. Despite renewed prosecutions and Julie Brown's groundbreaking work, much remains sealed from public view. Court documents, federal investigative files, flight logs, financial records, and grand jury materials related to the Epstein case are still locked behind DOJ doors. Despite public outcry from across the political spectrum, people in power do not seem willing to open the books and allow us to see the potentially explosive details. The case raises broader questions about government secrecy and accountability. Even Epstein's death investigation remains partially sealed, fueling speculation and conspiracy theories that might be put to rest with greater transparency. As Julie Brown has asked, why are we still protecting the powerful? The question resonates because the case demonstrated how wealth and connections can create a system where accountability becomes optional for those with enough resources and influence. The legacy media organizations that might have had the resources and legal standing to challenge these ongoing secrecy provisions are increasingly disappearing from the landscape. This creates a vicious cycle. Less oversight leads to more secrecy, which makes oversight even harder. What Julie K. Brown and the Miami Herald exposed was a system that prioritized reputation over accountability, connections over justice. The Epstein case provides a stark example of what investigative journalism can accomplish and what we lose when legacy media disappears. Brown's reporting didn't just expose a cover-up. It demonstrated that with resources, time, and institutional support, journalists can still hold the powerful accountable. Investigative journalism didn't just revive the Epstein case. It proved that democracy still has watchdogs, at least for now. But for now is the key phrase. The infrastructure that made Brown's reporting possible is eroding daily, one newspaper closure and newsroom consolidation at a time. The Columbia Journalism Review wrote following Epstein's arrest, "This is what happens when a reporter refuses to give up on a story. But refusal isn't enough without the resources to follow through. The truth doesn't die in darkness by accident. It requires light to survive. And increasingly, we're switching off the lights." This episode was researched using multiple primary sources, including the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Professional Responsibility's 2020 review of the Epstein case, federal court records, and FBI documentation from Operation Leap Year. The primary reporting sources include Julie K. Brown's original Perversion of Justice series in the Miami Herald from November 2018, her subsequent book of the same title, and multiple interviews she has given about her investigative process. Additional reporting comes from The Daily Beast, Talking Points Memo, CNN, The Washington Post, NPR, and other major news outlets that covered the case and the subsequent DOJ review. All timeline corrections and factual claims have been cross-referenced across multiple sources. Special attention was paid to distinguishing between verified facts and unconfirmed claims, particularly regarding alleged statements about Epstein's intelligence connections, which remain unverified reports rather than established facts. I'm Joel Chandler. Thank you for listening to another episode of Unsealed. Remember, the truth dies in the dark.